Lord's copies. I would like to come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
Do it. We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. And thing sucks.
And WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Good evening, and welcome into the dustbin of history. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. All right, at any rate, Gene Shepherd, by acclaim, acclaim of Robert Rodriguez, we're going to listen to a story of Jack Oakey. I believe there's maybe a slight error in the title of the thing has been dubbed 36 Jack Oakey film, but according to the records, the film is collegiate from 1935, but Gene Shepherd is going to talk all about it, and Ned Sparks, and Joe Penner, and Betty Grable. There's Betty Grable in it, it says here, Francis Langford. I don't know, looking at the poster, but let's hear it anyway. Gene Shepherd, lost episode from tomorrow in history, July 17th, 1962. To wrap up today's golden age of radio, what is it? This is the dustbin of history on WBAI New York. Gene Shepherd, not available anywhere, but right here in the dustbin.
You know, what I believe is a penny saved is a penny earned. You know, I believe that look before you leap. This is what I believe. I believe, look before you leap, and I also believe this, nothing ventured, nothing gained. That's what I believe. I also believe in motherhood. Boy, there's nobody can get tougher about motherhood than me. You just try to get tougher about motherhood. And kids, oh boy, let me tell you, kids. Dogs, oh, listen, there's nobody. What do you believe in? What do you believe in? I'd just like to know what your favorite thing is you believe in. E pluribus unum? Of course I believe in. Oh, are you kidding? You get off it. You're a wise guy. I also believe that you must learn to walk before you can run. I believe that. I've got all kinds of deep thoughts here that I believe in, and I'd like to know, what is your favorite deep thought? Would someone please out there look up the word maelstrom? Maelstrom. Victor Maelstrom, the famous Swedish film director, is here tonight to speak about his famous films, which he produces in The Dark of the Moon, and when it is Victor Maelstrom. I'll tell you about Maelstrom. I have discovered Greta Garbo. I'll tell you about Greta Garbo. I remember Ernst Lubitsch. You talk about Ernst. I remember Erich Stroheim before that film had a pair of gloves. You talk about a very famous movie man. I have discovered movies before. My name is Victor Maelstrom, and I know what a movie is about. A movie must experience life. It must go deep inside the man's psyche. A movie must produce, what is the word? It must produce the magic, that's it. Must produce the magic of an instant kind of sensation of believing in the other world. Like, it must, suddenly, you must produce a thing bigger than life. Greta Garbo, that bomb. I knew Greta Garbo before she was still selling ribbons at the department store when I discovered her, you know. I taught Erich von Stroheim how to take his gloves off. I showed him how you do with the finger. Where's the first finger and then the second finger? And then you take it off and you stand straight like a Russian officer. Von Stroheim is a bomb. I knew von Stroheim. You'll talk about movies. I'll tell you about movies. Jonas Mekas is a little kid there. I know about the music. I'll tell you about the first man who discovered montage. Me, montage. My middle name is montage. Victor Montage Maelstrom is my name. Actual name. That is where they come with the name, montage. You see what happened one day? I had the film in there, and I forgot to mark off how many frames we shoot. And I shoot another thing there, and I get what we call now a double exposure. Very interesting. So I come up with montage. Very fine. Very interesting artistic experience. I'll tell you how to make a movie still. No, they don't appreciate good movies anymore. They don't understand the artistry right now. That's what I say. Now, all of you line up there. We had a big scene here. Okay, now, all of you Roman soldiers, you stand up straight there. You are soldiers. All of you slaves, I want you to come in. Remember, you are slaves. I want you to lean over and rattle your chains when you come in. All the slaves, rattle chains. The first thing you think of when you think of a slave, what is it? A chain, that's right. You rattle chains. And all of you lions over there, you got the teeth out there. Get the teeth there, very well. With the lions there, and we must see the claws. You're thinking the lions, you're thinking the claws. Now get the claws out there, the lions there. And I want the chariots, I want to come in here. And what's the first thing you think of? The chariots? Race. That's right, you must race. And I want a wheel to come off. And I want all kinds of smoke and the crowds there. What is the first thing you think of? Oh, you're a movie star. Say, can you see why the stars burning bright and the now, Roddy, Roddy, you see, it's all part of education. You got to understand that education takes in many experiences. It takes in many human. I should say many failings, little frailties that come up from time to time. It's like learning to play the tissue paper comb. You have played the tissue paper comb. You take the comb. Now, any of you kids out there want to try it, go into the John, get a little of that stuff they advertise on the television shows, you know, with the little girls and the music and everything that plays. You know what that stuff is. You go in there and get it off the roll, tear some off, and take with the comb, you see. Take with a comb, and you lay it up against the comb, and then you hum. No, literally, you hum. Now, you open your mouth a little bit.
Bow, wow. Bow, wow.
Shut up, Charlie! I'm trying to teach him something! Then after you work a little while, you can get so that you can triple tongue it. Yeah, you see, now that's the end of our first lesson. And I feel that we're making progress in our real education here tonight. I don't know what education means to you. Of course, to many of you, speaking of education, it's fascinating, the change in our national attitude towards education. Last night, I saw this rotten old movie. You know, I wish some station would come on and have, at the end of its... at the end of a schedule ad, instead of saying a big late night TV preview, have you noticed that every movie that shows up on the very late shows always is called a first New York telecast? And I know that I saw one of them at least five times. What is this about? It reminds me of the man who owns one. Nobody ever really questions, you know. If you really did ask the man who owns one, you're liable to get one in the left eye. You know, I ask them, and they're better if they're toasted. But on the other hand, I'm watching this late movie, you see, and it's got Jack Oakey in there, old fatty Jack Oakey, you see. But in this case, he is still skinny. It's very spooky seeing Jack Oakey skinny. It's like seeing a skinny Charles Laughton, you know. You just say, isn't Charles Laughton? I mean, seriously, and he's not only skinny, he's the romantic lead with a little thin mustache. And it's still Jack Oakey, you know, there's the slob all over. This was back in the days when what they call the common man was a very big, important thing in the United States. The common man. This was in the 1930s. As a matter of fact, this film was made in 1936, the announcer said. And the theory of the common man was fascinating. Now, today we call him a slob. In those days, he was called the common man, and everybody thought he was the wonderful, the salt of the earth, you know. And that his basic philosophies about things really were true. That everything that he believed, that the common man believed, was in a sense true. I mean, it was really true because he was common. There was the belief that the great herd knew. Well, anyway, here comes Jack Oakey. Now, this was the premise of the story. The wildest premise. And one thing else. I will award the Brass Figligi. Did any of you see that film last night? I will award the Brass Figligi with bronze oak leaf palm to the listener who rises above the muck, the sordid, rotten mud of listenerdom, for one brief moment, rises like a small fish hitting a large plug. Just one brief moment, a flash in the sun there, if you can identify the magnificent automobile. Oh, what a gasser. The magnificent automobile that played a prominent role in that fantastically bad movie last night with Joe Penner. And yet it wasn't fantastically bad because it said so much about the attitudes of the time. And there was a lot of funny stuff in it, too, in an odd kind of way. Joe Penner and Betty Grable. Oh, boy. What fantastic acting. Joe Penner, Betty Grable. And by the way, the two best people in the whole show were Penner. Penner was very consistently bad. And consistently interesting because of his, you know, his consistency. And Jack Oakey, in a sort of slobbish way, you see, he was the very antithesis of what we call the Anthony Perkins syndrome, which is the hero of today, which is an infinitely sensitive man. He's as far removed from the slob as you can get, you know, at least theoretically. And that was the Anthony Perkins syndrome, which we have now. Whereas the hero of most of the movies of the 30s, that if you really look at them, was the common man. Lumpy men. grown-up men, and they weren't boys, they were grown-up men. Jack Oakey, at no point in the show, at no point in this movie, did he play a kid, you know. He was Jack Oakey, and he was a grown-up man. He had double-breasted suits, he drank liquor, he chased women, he bet on the horses, you know. He was a grown-up man. Well, here was the thing about that movie, though, that was fascinating to watch. He inherited a girls' school. Now, you gotta understand this was in the midst of the most gigantic depression the world has ever known. Everybody was out of work, everybody was having, it was rotten. In 1936, nobody was working. And so, almost all their movies were about these windfall things, like a guy inheriting a gigantic amount of money, you know? This was the dream that everybody had, and most people in our world live in dreams of one kind or another. And if the dreams don't come true in their life, they go to the movies where they always do. I mean, where Cary Grant, in spite of being 1,600 years old, is still infinitely attractive to chicks, you know? This is part of the dream world. Where Doris Day, in spite of being 1,600 years old and having 1,600 kids, is still a virgin and will continually be, and will always be, fantastically successful. I mean, and the two of them go through the most clean delineation of our kind of dream can be found in this new Doris Day, Cary Grant movie, where for seven reels, Cary chases Doris and Doris runs away from Cary, and both of them are cute and oopsie pie all the way through, you know. And I mean, it's a total dream world. Had no relationship to real life at all, you know. Never once does she ever turn and say, oh, come on, you're an old bore. Will you cut it out? And not only that, you're old enough to be not only my father, but my grandfather. And never once does he ever turn to you and say, oh, wow, what am I chasing these nine-year-old chicks who sit around with lollipops in their ears? Oh, boy, are you a pain in the... Whew. Speaking of pains, this is WOR, AM at FM New York. And speaking of the dream world, Bert Parks, the jovial MC with the slick finish, strangely enough, is a controversial figure. I'd like to point out something about these stories that run in all fan mags, whether they're TV guide types or movie guide types. No matter who they talk about, they could talk about Santa Claus, and they come on, Santa Claus. In spite of the wonderful jovial image that Santa Claus gives to the screen and to the lovers of Santa Clausdom, he is a dark, sinister figure whose cross currents of psychological problems have been bugging him ever since he was a child. Learn how he's overcome these and other fantastic inside stories about Santa Claus. Yes, learn about the real Santa Claus, an in-depth profile of this man of sinister, dark urges who has suppressed them throughout all the years to bring light and gladness and joy to the children of the world. Read about it in the December issue, the Christmas issue of TV Guide. The Santa Claus issue, an in-depth profile of a controversial figure. But popular. Well, anyway, old friendly Bert is also controversial. He answers his critics in this week's TV Guide magazine. Next, read TV Guide's razor-sharp analysis of the competitive impact of the giant of mass communications, television. Read how Radio, for one, has made a very successful policy transition by forgetting all about programs and concentrating on dough. Read about this in this week's TV Guide. Yes. Exciting features, plus the most complete and accurate local program information available anywhere are yours in the TV Guide. Yes, learn about the sinister dark currents that lie just below that wonderful jovial surface of Gene Shepard. Is he what he really seems to be? Learn about the real Gene Shepard. Listen to that. You'll find out. Wait till I make my move. You'll learn what I'm really doing here. We have our plans. Yes, and you had better make prepared to have your papers ready when the time comes. Because we are not going to fool around. Now, speaking of... doesn't make any difference what we were speaking of, I suppose, one way or the other. But I must say that getting back to this movie, which told a great deal about our world. Here was Jack Oakey. You remember this, 1936. And hardly anybody in 1936 had any education. Remember that. That the great college craze was to come immediately following World War II. You understand that, don't you? that colleges began to be the thing you go to rather than the thing you talk about or make fun about after World War II, when a lot of guys got the GI Bill of Rights and rather than work, they went and goofed off at Marquette. And they got hooked on it. And then very shortly thereafter, the whole thing began to build, and the next thing you know, everybody's going to school. Well, this is another world. In 1936, hardly anybody had gone to college. And particularly the guys who were grown up. That most people who grew up, let us say in the 20s, they were lucky to have finished high school. They really were lucky to have finished high school in most of the American homes of the time. Are you aware of that? And many people never went to high school. As a matter of fact, I remember hearing my father talk about when you finished eighth grade in Chicago, when he was a boy, you had your choice of either going to what they called a business school. A business school was a place where you just learned to type or learned to file, or going to high school for a year. That was all you had to go. Yeah, because the law said that you didn't have to go to school after you were 14. Well, most people assumed that meant you were through with school by the time you were 14. The idea was not that you should go to school to finish. It was that you go to school as long as the law compelled you to go. That's literally the way it was among most people in America. Are you aware of that in those days? Yes, it was. And as a matter of fact, there are probably 18 billion Americans still sitting out there who feel vaguely cheated by the world. Because they... Yes, that's true. Because college was a thing which only rich people went to. Rich people and or what they used to call the intellectual, and that was with caps. And it was said with a kind of a sarcasm, the intellectual kind, you know. They would go, the long-haired men, they always referred to it, it was a note of derision about people who went to college. Now, yes, it was a very different world. Now, that was reflected in their movies. Because the movies were the great, and still remain to this day, the great medium of the masses, just like the television shows remain the great medium of the masses. Now, don't tell me they don't deal with truth. They do. Because if a show consistently refutes the ideas that the masses already hold, because one thing that separates the masses from the rest of the world, I suspect, is that they have a total inability to ever change their ideas. Not really. Whereas the intellectual is continually searching for ideas and, as a matter of fact, is generally not committed to an idea. He is committed to ideas. It's very different. And so it's almost impossible to talk, say, an old-time Southerner out of the idea of integration. You just can't do it. Forget it. You can hope for his youngsters, but forget the older guy. Have you ever tried to talk? Well, you just can't do it. This is the way the mass generally works, whether you like it or not. And so, and again, I hate to use such words as mass, but let's say the great preponderance of people. So when you get involved, oh, you're going to do the thing, Ted? All right, no, oh, okay. So when you get involved with dealing with the mass public, say like putting out a million-dollar movie. Now, what you generally do, a successful movie is that which bolsters the ideas of the mass, which tells them that the idiocy that they've already believed in is really true, and it's wonderful. Then that is a genuinely successful movie. Now, on the intellectual level, you have the same thing. So if Salinger tells the guy who reads him that he really is a sensitive, wonderful creature, then it becomes successful with the guy that reads it, because that bolsters his illusion. Now, his illusion is a little more literate than the guys below him, but it's no less an illusion. And so the guy who comes home from the steel mill every night, and he's a guy, he can hardly really read, and he always has felt, and he has made a rationalization about this years ago. He decided that reading isn't good for people anyway. I don't believe in that reading stuff, for crying out loud, hurt your eyes. I want my kid to go out and play ball like a kid. I want him to get out and hit the ball. That's what I want. I don't want him sitting around getting all these nutty ideas, all this intellectual jazz, that rotten stuff. See, he's made an adjustment there. He's saying that I can't read, and since I can't read, reading is a bad thing, and that's why I can't read. I could read if I wanted to read. You know, and a poor guy, you know, he follows the lines and he talks to himself when he reads. And the best thing that he can ever do is make it through, perhaps, TV Guide. He might even make it through a comic book and maybe the racing form. And he can read the sport page, which is mostly numbers. So here you've got the situation. So to bolster him, to provide him with a successful thing that he digs, you can't tell him that's wrong. because he will not ever change. He will be very unhappy about being told that he's been wrong all his life. So in a subtle way, tell him he's right. And he will go out with a warm feeling, and he will love all of mankind. And you got the successful film. You've got the successful product. This goes all, even into the most intellectual of plays, for example. If you see, that's one of the great beliefs in America is that there is an answer to things. Somehow there will be a guy come up with the right formula. The right politician will get in and be, oh, okay, well, reduce taxes, it's going to be better. Well, you know, this is not only sophistry, it's also borders on the absurd. But we believe it, so that's the way it is. So every American play has to come up with an end. It's got to tell the guy in the end, a conclusion must be reached. Either man is rotten, that's a conclusion. Man is great, that's a conclusion. Man has got a great future, if only he can learn but to do so-and-so. That's a great conclusion, you see. All right, but none of them actually are conclusions, because history doesn't bear out any of these conclusions at any point along the line. And incidentally, it's also wise to point out at this point that at any given point in history, the people felt that they were at the pinnacle of man's development. Are you aware of that? Now, you're going to say, oh, yeah, but we're different. We're aware. We're aware people. Don't you think the Egyptians thought that they were? And believe me, 1,000 years from now, the people will believe that we were in the Dark Ages. And they will say, but we're aware people. You can't talk about the people of 1960 like you're talking about civilized people. You're talking about simple tribesmen who believe. And, you know, they're going to do that because it will be true. So now you've got a real problem there to decide whether the answer is an answer or whether it's just pure fiction. Or it's a belief in an answer that somehow seems to be part of the thing. And so if you can come out and say that here's the answer, everyone goes out feeling warm. Now, he might not like the answer, but he feels satisfied. There's been an answer given. Now, and he can either reject it or accept it, but he's satisfied you made your statement. Now, if, on the other hand, you do say Waiting for Godot, which is really a reflection of life, where one guy says, oh, let's play ball, Charlie. Watch me for the jello. Ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding. He's playing a ball. He's throwing a ball. The other guy says, oh, my shoe fell off. Just a minute. Let me talk about the shoe. Oh, let's talk about shoes for a while, Charlie. And they talk about, oh, the shoes. I tie the shoe there. Hey, do you think Godot's going to come? Oh, I don't know. Oh, don't bug me with that stuff. I don't know. Come to think of it. Oh, look at that. Look at that guy. There's an airplane. Woo! Let's talk about airplanes now for a while. Ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding. And this is exactly the way life is. And about every 30 seconds, somebody says, hey, you know what we ought to do is have peace here. Peace. Oh, we'll talk about peace for a while. Ding, 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 ding. And it goes, this is exactly the way life is. And everyone believes that it has continuity. Well, look back in your life. I don't have to say anymore. Now, I know immediately, hey, dear Mr. Shepherd, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a Schraft lady, and I'd like to tell you this, that I have every plan, I have every moment of my life. Why, I was talking to Charles the other day. Charles, will you please give me my notes? I want to tell... Well, it goes on and on. However, last night, watching this wonderful picture, which reflected the times, which reflected 1936... far more than the people of 1936 probably recognized that it did. Here was the basic premise of the movie. And you know they could never make a movie like this because people would be angry about it. It started out with Jack Oakey inherited a college. He inherited a girls' school. Well, you walk into the girls' school, you see. And so he says, oh, what do we want to do with a girls' school? And Ned Sparks says, what do you want to do with a girls' school? Well, there must be some way to make dough with a girls' school. So you had Jack Oakey and Ned Sparks are going to run a girls' school. Well, now remember, Jack Oakey is Mr. Average Man. Not college. He hasn't done anything like this. He's just a clunk, and he's inherited a girls' school. Ned Sparks says, I don't know how we're going to make money in a girls' school. This is where I came in. I'm leaving. Doesn't that sound like Sparks? Well, that's the way Sparks was. So they go into the girls' school, and they walk around the girls' school, and here is a school of classical dimensions. They have a bust of Socrates in the corner, and they have a bust of Aristotle in this corner, and they have a group of girls playing a Haydn string quartet, and they're working on it, and there's a lady saying, "Now, would you please go back to the second bar there in the third chorus? I would like to work over the presto movement, please. Mr. Haydn wrote this to be played just a little faster. 1, 2, 3. And the girls were playing, look at the ding, ding. They were playing Haydn. Now, don't get involved in a hassle there. We got to, afterwards, we do that. So they're playing Haydn. Now, on the other hand, they walk around through the school, and in the school there is a professor who is teaching girls history, and he is saying, "Girls, as you probably know, in the second battle of Manassas," and he went on and on, and so as each door opens, as what's his name? Jack Oakey and Ned Sparks look. You can see the disgust coming over their minds, you see. They're running into education, is what literally they're running into. And that is distasteful to them and an object of fun and disgust, you see. So they see the Haydn. That's an object of fun. I can just see the 1936 audience. This is pre-hi-fi, pre-stereo. Remember that. This is pre-the electronic workshop. This is any of these things that we know today. And so Haydn is an object of fun. That's called, oh, that long hair music, oh, that nutty long hair sound, that noise. Oh, you don't want to hear. What the kids want today is swing. That's what they want. That's the kind of education kids want. And so Jack Oakey goes into his office, and this is the scene that transpired. He says, "Ned, I've got an idea. I'm going to make this school pay." Well, now there is an American dream, if ever, making the school pay. That means dough coming into the coffers. It has nothing to do with education, you see. And so everybody sitting out there says, aha, now things are going to happen in this movie. Now the good stuff is happening. I'm going to make this school pay. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I've got a great idea. What is it that everybody wants today? What do they want their daughters to know today? What is it? Do they want them to know reading? Nah. Do they want them to know history? Nah. Do they want them to know music? Nah. What they want them to do is to be charming. Yeah, they want them to be the kind of girl that they would like to have. They'd like to meet themselves. The kind of girl that knows how to wear duds real good. The kind of girl that knows how to put makeup on real good. The kind of girl that knows how to dance real good to real good music. That's what they want out of education. And that's the kind of school we're going to do here. We're going to go out. We're going to get all the greatest teachers in the world. The greatest tap dancer is going to teach them kids how to dance. And the greatest Hollywood star is going to come in here and show them how to wear them duds. And they're going to learn how to put on that makeup. That's the kind of education. And that's the kind of education that we're going to have. And we're all going to be happy. And this school is going to pay. And this school is make dough. It's going to make dough. So let's go, Ned. I don't know whether this is going to work out. But, by George, I'm along with you. Come on, let's go, Ned. We're going to go on. We're going to make this school pay. Come here, Betty Grable. Betty, you're in charge of classics here. You're going to get up on that old table there. And you're going to dance in the library. And you're going to say, yes, sir. Socrates, yeah, get rid of that. Put up a picture of Clark Gable. That's the kind of education we want. I don't know, boss, but I'm with you all the way. Come on, let's go. We're on our way. Oh, look at that now. That's the kind of education we want. Tell you now, I've got all you parents here gathered together, and you want to know what kind of education your daughters are getting here. Well, there's been a lot of changes here. Right, girls? Whee! Yep, we've got right into all that reading. Whee! And all that writing. You know, none of your kids want to learn how to write, do you? Whee! And we got rid of all that classical music. Right, girls? Whee! And now I want to show all of you parents that have gathered here that you've sent your girls to the right school. I want to show all of you parents that you've sent them to the right school and you're going to learn the right things. You're going to learn charm. Charm, that's an American thing. And charm is what we all want. Charm, we want to be able to sparkle. We want to be able to sing and dance. Yeah, we don't want to
politic. That isn't what you girls should learn. You want to learn how to be charming, all right? And now I'll let Dole will come in and we'll have a successful school here. We're going to get the biggest football team in the Western Hemisphere. And we're going to have a... Everybody's going to be a cheerleader here. We're going to teach them twirling and marching and dancing and singing. And they're going to have cheers like you never heard before. Rah, rah, razzmatazz.
Well, it was a fantastic movie, and we were given to believe by watching this movie that what he had done was a good thing. Now, that's the thing that's important about it. He was not pointed out as an object of ridicule, nor an object of slobism rampant. It was a good thing that he had done. He had got rid of all this long hair junk. He got rid of all this education junk. And he substituted what the great true story, the true confession reading public believes is real education, is why Eddie and Debbie didn't make it. That's real education. You see, that's true history. I'd like to ask the average member of the mob what his concept of history is. He could tell you the date that Jack Pa left. He could tell you all the husbands that Elizabeth Taylor's had. He could tell you how many fights Rocky Marciano had. And he could tell you what year the Giants lost the pennant. And he could tell you what year Bobby Thompson hit the home run. This is a basic history. Has nothing to do with the War of the Roses, you see. Has nothing to do with the Second Battle of Manassas. Has nothing to do whatsoever with the world of, let's say, the world of affairs of men. It's a fascinating kind of history. So if you were to actually teach history, the kind of history that many people think is history, you would start out with the founding of the American League, you know, and the invention of the motion picture. These were the beginnings of history for most people. And of course, ancient history would be Billy the Kid, or say, ancient history would be Bronco Billy and the perils of Pauline. That would be the parallel in his mind to, say, the study of Egyptology. It would bear, you know, it's just a theoretical thing. He runs into it occasionally, and he will chuckle over that, and it might be a little interesting, but it's Egyptology to him. It's like our ancient archaeology. Now then, you have to, his history then really begins when you tell him, when you mention Hoot Gibson. Ah, Hoot Gibson, I remember when I was a kid. Now you're talking history. And you also mention a prominent center fielder of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Duke Snyder? I'll tell you about Duke Snyder. Let me tell you about Dixie Walker. Now there was an outfielder. Now you're talking real history. This is genuine history to people. And then you ask him about the Model A. He can tell you the whole line of genealogy of cars. He can tell you how the Model A became... He can tell you about the Model A becoming the Model B. He can tell you what year Ford put a V8 engine in its car. And he can tell you what year that Chevy came out with the overhead valve 6. And all of these things are what could be called basic history. And as far as Hitler and all that, you couldn't ever find out to him. It would only be really, it would be theoretical. It would be very unusual if you ever ask him, when did Hitler come into power? All he could tell you about is when he got drafted. You could say, well, I'll tell you, I was in 42, I'll never forget it, 1942, I just got out of high school. And in 42, I'll tell you, I remember it because I had just got a 37 Hudson that year. I remember I had his 37 Hudson, and I was working at the Consolidated Bolt and Nut Company. I had just gotten the job, and I'll never forget, I had just been promoted. Yeah, I remember now, yeah. They put me in the invoice file department. I'll never forget that, and I got this letter, and it says I was drafted. Of course, they were drafting a lot of guys then. Yeah, that's when Hitler came in, yeah. and then you ask him about World War II. I'll never forget the time down at USO in Red Bank. I went in there, there was a chick there, you know, she was only junior league deb kinds, and she's behind her with the donuts, you know, and I walked, I said, how about it, baby? I'll tell you about World War II. And then I'll never forget the time. That's his concept of World War II, you see. That really is his concept. And then finally you say, well, what about it? I mean, how did you feel when the Japanese finally sort of, you're talking about VJ? Let me tell you, VJ Day, I'll tell you where I was. In VJ Day, I was in Paris, you see, and they sent me back on a 3-day pass, and I'll tell you, I met this chick, and she's a VJ Day. I said, what? She said, VJ Day, here, what? And I said, how about it, baby? Oh, tell you about VJ. Well, there we are. And it goes on and on and on. This is his concept of World War II. Now, yes. And then you get down throughout his life, and about the time when you ask him about other things that have to do. Now, then from there in on, you see, you will find there, then his history then begins to be a combination of half-read headlines that he read once passing through the subway by somebody who was trying to get to the racing form in the Daily News. There is where his headlights begin. You say to him, well, what year did the Japanese, what actual year did we give the Philippines their independence? Well, the Philippines, what do you mean the Philippines independence? I have no idea about that. I guess it was after the war there sometime, the Philippines independence. What do you mean, they didn't overbelong us, did they? What do you mean independence? Don't they still belong there? Oh, I don't know about that stuff. That politics never interests me there. Well, you're not asking them about politics. You're asking them about world history, you see. But somehow the word politics, if you say politics never interested me, that lets you off the hook. But there has never been a man that politics did not interest when you really get down to politics. What he's saying is that history never interests me, nor does the affairs of the world interest me. So then you ask him such a simple thing as, well, what month and what year did the Korean War start?
I'll tell you, I had got out of the Army, I'll never forget, it was 1946, I got out of the Army out. Oh, I remember, I'll tell you, I moved over on 123rd, no, I'll tell you, it was when I moved over to 2nd Avenue, yeah. I lived on 2nd Avenue down on 7th, yeah, that's right, I had just moved from 2nd Avenue, I lived down there on 34th Street, then I moved over, and I was living in, I'll tell you where I was living at that time, I was living in Brooklyn Heights, yeah, I remember that. Because you see what happened is that the Army sent me a letter, and it got sent over to me there, I remember they're gonna. It was 1952.
You say no, Charles. It was 1950.
No, it couldn't have been that long ago. Oh, come on,
and it goes on and on. So, but if you ask him something that is really part of his world, he is infallible. If you say to him, "What year did the Brooklyn Dodgers beat the Giants for the pennant?" Beat the Giants out in the run-up.
Oh, what are you talking about? Oh, why don't you ask me something hard?
And you say, well, what year did Pete Reeser come up? And how many times did Pete Reeser, what was Pete Reeser's chief problem in the big,
oh, I'll tell you what, everybody knows what year come out, the chief problem, the guy kept running the wall. Guy couldn't judge the walls, I couldn't run, I'll never forget, one day I'm out there watching him play, and Reeser goes out at the fly ball, I see one run the wall, I'm like, hey Reeser, look out the wall, pow! Guy couldn't see the wall.
I said, well, that's very, very good. I mean, after all these years, you remember one problem that one man had in the big...
Well, who could forget Reeser running into the wall?
I said, but you forgot the Korean War, Charlie.
I don't care about politics. Not politics, Carl. Well, okay, about politics.
Well, so in the end, you know, this guy winds up in 1962. And, oh, incidentally, one of the fascinating things about this guy is that his vote counts as much as somebody who knows. And somehow... people believe that if you get enough of these yucks together, that you're going to get the right decision. This is one of the most fascinating illusions that history has always provided us with. The great illusion that if you get a mass together, they will always make the right decision. And by the way, any guy who wants to get the mass on his side tells him that. This is one of the old political stratagems to come out and say, I believe innately that the man on the street in his vast infinite wisdom, his animal-like belief in good and evil, will always come up with the right answer. I don't hold with these intellectuals who talk about things like moral concepts and good and evil. I have a deep and abiding respect for the man on the street. Of course, all the men on the street say, yeah, amen, amen. I always come up with the right answer. And so it's a fascinating thing, and I'm watching this movie last night, to get back to the original concept. I'm watching this movie last night, and it's all there, you know? And there is Jack Oakey throwing the rascals out. The rascals, in this case, being the people who had education, you know?
Throw them rascals out. Get rid of that lady. And they threw the poor old lady out that was teaching them hiding. And they brought this chick in from Broadway who taught him to say, "Yes, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, I don't mean me." They got a couple of Broadway songwriters to come in and teach music. Believe it or not. And we were supposed to feel this gradual enlightening now coming in. It was enlightening. They felt that enlightenment was coming into the school. And you know, there is a great number of people who really do still believe that. Then enlightenment would come the day they threw out all them books, all that crazy stuff, all the long hair stuff. Yeah, I think I want my kid to learn Latin. What I want him to learn how to do is to operate a lathe so he can earn a living. That's what I want. And you know, in the end, you still have a large number of people who are definitely against education. Education itself is a wrong thing. It's a very bad thing. And because they don't have it primarily. Because anyone who has it cannot possibly be against it. So the only people who are against religion are, and that's another one too. The people who are against education are dead set against it because they have felt inferior all their lives about it. And the one way you can reduce that inferiority problem is to not allow anyone to rise to a superior position. This, by the way, is one of the most subtle and one of the most sneaky and most effective lures of communism. Communism does not bring the little man up. It brings the big man down. So in the end, it tells some little guy who's running around the village having trouble and writing obscene stuff on the walls that when you get communism, all of us are going to be little guys running around writing stuff on the walls. And he feels wonderful about this. This is his concept of justice. And so it's a very sneaky lure. And it's one of those kind of things that, in a way, is almost impossible to beat. But I'll never forget the look on Jack Oakey's face. And I want all of you folks to come on, gather down here. Come on, Granny, I want all of you folks to come out. He has a sort of half Brooklyn accent. You know how Jack Oakey talks real fast? He said, come here, baby. And I want you to, and we're all going to sing here now. We're all going to sing here. Yes, sir, that's my baby. And he was running around in the dean's office. You remember that scene? He's running around in the dean's office, and this was the first day he came in, and he has just brought the two Broadway songwriters down. They're throwing out Haydn, and you should have heard the almost incredibly bad song. Here was the song he was singing. Oh, baby, you're the cream on my coffee. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Baby, you're as smooth as a kitten. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Oh, baby, I dig you all the way. Ra-ta-ta-ta, ra-ta-ta-ta. Baby, you're just as smooth as cream. And all the while, all the college girls are gathering around the new dean. And they have this wonderful look that only a 30-year-old chorus girl can have when she's playing a 17-year-old seminary student. They all have that wonderful look that at last education is entering this sacred halls. Isn't it right, Myrtle? It's so good to have somebody down here who can really talk. Yes, sir, that's my baby. I know, sir, you don't want to learn how to reading and all that writing. Yes, folks, and we're going to bring in charm. That's what makes the world go round, charm. And we're going to have plenty of it here.
Jay, ending in almost a timely fashion this evening. And that's a lost episode of Gene Shepherd from the Hines Collection from Tuesday, July 17th, 1962. And we'll have another Gene Shepherd episode that isn't available online or anywhere else next week. Yeah, you can only get them here in the dustbin of history. Thanks to Jim Clavin for curating them and sending them along. FlickLives.com, your website for everything about Gene Shepherd. FlickLives.com. Complete log of every known program. Annotated. true facts about all of the people Shepard talks about on this program. Were they real? Were they fictitious? Find out in the people section of FlickLives.com. Oh, it's a treasure trove of well-researched stuff. Jim Clayton does an amazing job, and we thank him for all he does. All right, so coming up, Jimmy Dore, and at 3 o'clock, What's the Frequency, Kenneth, a musical. At 4 o'clock, I'm going to be digging for an old golden age of radio to put on, since Hoppe Selassie can't make it in to do Burn Baby Burn tonight. And Lister always insists that we put on an old golden age of radio. That's it. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back Sunday night, 8 to 10 for the Golden Age Radio, and back here next week, another edition of the Dustbin of History.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.